Hi, I'm Ashley.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Lindsay.
We're your hosts at Pineapple Pizza Podcast, where we cook up fresh and flavorful weekly specials of mythology,
cryptozoology,
and urban legends inspired by regions around the world.
If you're craving history, world culture, strange and obscure stories, and a dash of inappropriate humor, join us for a bite every Sunday.
You can find us on all major streaming platforms.
Come for the laughs.
Stay for the flavor.
Hello, and welcome to Reverie True Crime. I'm your host, Paige.
Serial killer.
I'm not a serial killer, and I'm not a murderer. I know that when I die, I'm going to heaven, and I'm going to have Jesus right beside me. And I'm going to have them on Judgment Day in front of me, and they're going to pay for their wrongdoing. I am innocent. It was self-defense.
The legal system didn't believe you.
I do not regret it. Do not regret it. They were going to kill me. I killed them. That is a normal thing to do. It's a human thing. I did the right thing, or I wouldn't be here today.
Women give life. Some women take it away. I don't condone murder. I think most of you are aware of that. If not, let's make that clear right from the beginning. What I do is explore case studies, psychology, and the opinions of violent women, and I'm sharing the information that I've found with you. I want to bring different perspectives to the table, because this case, the case of Eileen Wuornos, has been studied and reported on for years. It's interesting. It's intense. It goes deeper than just serial killing. Humans are complicated. We are multifaceted, just like this case. All too often, men get a hall pass for the violence they commit. People say, well, they're obviously fed up or stressed. There seem to be a lot of excuses for men when they act out, but like loose change, it's unnecessary, and it never adds up. Hell, excuses are made for them because the person may have deserved it, or that's simply what happens when someone is pushed too far. But this isn't Marvel or DC. When pushed too far, you don't become a hero. You're a murderer. You see, the patriarchy has defined women as being solely baby makers, cooks, wives, mothers, and people who should be quiet and better seen than heard. Have things gotten better? Maybe. Are they consistently better? Not even close.
But the seventh man that you shot, did you say to yourself, I'm out of control. I'm killing people. I need help.
No, I thought to myself, those men are out of control. I'm sick and tired of those men out there thinking they can control us and do whatever they damn well please with our bodies and think they can get away with it because it's a male-dominant society and we're gonna treat you the way we want to, abuse you, treat you, destroy you. It don't matter to us because we can get away with doing that.
How many news stories do we hear about when someone's hands are put on a woman when they didn't consent? What do we usually hear? It must have been the victim who did something wrong and deserved it. We, as women, get blamed often for how men decide to react to us or what they do to us. Things are said to our faces such as, "You should not have been wearing that revealing outfit. What did you do to make him so angry?" I mean, even coming forward about any kind of abuse or sexual assault leads to disbelief or inaction. In the nearsighted eyes of some, women and men are two different animals, so to speak. But this misses the trees for the forest. Men and women hail from far more places than just Mars and Venus. the world is not as reductionist as some would like to believe. Despite this, violence perpetrated by men sometimes results in them being seen by some as macho, prideful, sticking up for themselves, prone to physically acting out. The old adage, boys will be boys. In short, it's normalized by many. Women are often characterized as nurturers, docile, and physical action is seen as outrage and not how a woman is supposed to act. A lot of little girls grow up in environments where they are taught to see men's outbursts and violence as normal. Women often tell little girls, "I forgave him because I shouldn't have said what I did. I upset him. It's my fault." On the other side of the river called double standard, women who raise their voices or verbally lash out in self-defense are told they are overreacting, being a bitch, too aggressive. Hegemonic masculinity is a phrase not many know. It could also be seen as toxic masculinity. How do we define this? Gender studies defines it using these characteristics: restricted experience and expression of emotion, no emotional sensitivity, toughness and violence, powerful and successful, self-sufficient, stoicism, being a stud, misogyny. This can be reduced down to the typical cowboy image. This is what is accepted even today. But we also talked about the other side too. Hegemonic femininity is defined as compliance to patriarchy, confined to power relations, sweet disposition, modesty, investment in physical appearance, sexual attractiveness that privileges thinness. You can't look at Instagram today and say it's any different. The reality is that there are multiple masculinities and femininities. The reality is that many refuse to accept the reality. In the 19th and early 20th century, women who killed their masters, pimps, or johns did so out of self-defense. That's another reality. They had either been raped or beaten, or their children had been abused. They referred if they didn't do something, they and or their children would eventually be killed. I mean, why would it be any different today? 99% of murders, whether sexually driven, a mass murder, or serial killings, are executed by men. At this point, it's almost expected. 10% of violent offenders are women. The ones who do kill, in most cases, and not all, kill persons they are intimate with because they've been abused or their children have been abused or sexually assaulted, and they killed out of self-defense. Women who kill are more often than not called crazy, but we never consider the why. I mean, if you're a sex worker, you have no right to complain if someone does something sexual to you that oversteps your boundaries, right? What boundaries? I mean, you knew what you were getting yourself into. If you're that upset or hurt, mentally or physically, go to the police. Stop doing sex work. It's that simple, right? Wrong.
I was raped, tormented, badly, and I'm sitting on death row for defending myself, justifiable homicide.
You're explaining now that these men were abusive in your opinion. Do you understand that for many people, because you were a prostitute, they don't understand how a prostitute can be raped?
I don't understand how nobody can understand that how a prostitute can be raped, because when a man rapes a woman. He assaults your whole body. He puts his down your throat, cramming it down your throat. He tears your hair out of your head. He beats your face in. He rips your wide open.
In the case of sex workers, someone who is a sex worker who defends herself in the only way that she knows how might be due to her surroundings, upbringing, mental illness, emotional instability, and more. You'd probably say she's bad, insane, out of her mind, evil, or even a monster. And you know what? Maybe all of those descriptors are true. Some will see that woman as a monster. Some will see them without a soul. Some will say she is a strong badass doing what her instincts told her while experiencing extreme fight or flight. Some will also see the woman boiled down to the basics, a human being experiencing frightening situations while choosing to protect herself. Others will see that woman as a cold and calculating, heartless bitch who doesn't deserve redemption. Presently, women are still looked down on for being exotic dancers, having an OnlyFans account, working as a sex worker, and essentially doing anything revealing or sexual for monetary gain. However, the men who go to strip clubs, throw money at exotic dancers, watch porn, or anything of a sexual nature, it's completely normal behavior that most don't think twice about. Most men who have multiple women as arm candy and throw money at exotic dancers are idolized by young boys and other men. It's the women that generally get condemned, called a slut, a whore, repulsive, and in the eyes of society as a whole, sex workers especially, it's these women's lives that are valued less than others. These double standards have been hammered away into most of our psyches since we were mere children, sometimes not even intentionally. It's simply widely accepted as the way things are and have been since the beginning of time. Many people automatically spew venomous slurs and judgments towards women without thinking twice about it, because that's what they were taught. That's how they view women who are not of the submissive nature, who are sexually liberated, and no one will ever be able to change the perspectives of the people who starkly judge these women. After all, our perspectives are our own realities, and some people are not willing to explore anyone else's reality outside of their own. Women who get arrested for prostitution get punished and sentenced harsher than violent male offenders. Unlike most men, women who have felt desperate, pushed into a corner, and killed to survive, or even kidnap their children to protect them from the perpetrator, are usually eager to tell the truth in court, to explain everything that happened that drove her to that being the only way out, the only option in those moments she felt she had. These women think the criminal justice system will care about what they have endured. But their honesty, their wishful thinking that someone will listen, believe them, and have an ounce of compassion only gets them punished. In the case of Eileen Warnos, everyone will have to decide for themselves if they believe she's the same as the likes of serial killers Richard Ramirez or Ted Bundy. The majority of serial killers are white males who hunt, torture, and rape their victims. Their targets most of the time are sex workers because, unfortunately, they know as well as we all do, Society does not value their lives. They're not seen as human. Most serial killers have a deep hatred for women. How many serial killer characteristics that have so far been written about apply to Eileen? Did she kill out of self-preservation each time, a few times, or even one time? Did she kill simply because she was a callous, cold-blooded murderer who got off on the so-called thrill of it? Did she commit these murders only wanting to rob these men of their money, or because she was sexually gratified by it?
As if anybody ever comes up to me again and ever tries to rape me like that, he will definitely wish he had not met this prostitute.
But I gotta ask you, one case, you claim rape, you say I shot him in self-defense. But seven killings?
It wasn't every day. I was out prostituting, and I was dealing with hundreds and hundreds of guys. You got a jerk that's going to come along and try to rape me, I'm going to fight.
But you don't blow people away. You blew them away.
Oh, jeez.
But most prostitutes encounter some kind of
violence. Yeah, what do? They get killed or something then?
Some
yeah,
do.
No. I don't believe in that. I believe in everybody has a right to self-defend themselves. I don't care who you are.
Neurodevelopment, psychosocial issues, and sexual deviancy are common in people who commit serial killings. Some of those issues do apply to Eileen, but are those issues the main reasons for committing these murders? Humans are complicated creatures who should be studied on a case-by-case basis. What would you do if you were in a heated, terrifying situation, feeling like it is either coming down to saving your own life, maybe even your children's lives? It comes down to you or the perpetrator. Who are you going to choose?
You killed a loved one.
So? They almost killed me. Who's supposed to die? It's a battle. That's the way it is. That's life. You got a battle going between life and death. Whoever wins, more power to you. I mean, that is the way it is. That's life.
There are so many ways to look at every case, and opinions will vary. I'm here with statistics and case studies in an attempt to turn the wheels of your mind. I'm here to present to you different sides of research that I have found and let you come to your own conclusions. It's really easy to say someone is an evil monster. It's harder to picture a killer as a human being. Burrow deeper into the gray areas and not just consider a case in black or white. There will always be questions that go unanswered. And we are only speculative, curious beings forming opinions based on these killers' life histories, the contexts, and the trials. No one opinion is wrong. That's why it's an opinion. And I respect whatever yours may be after hearing the information I've laid out for you and the story that's about to unfold. We are constantly bombarded with stories of people every day. No matter who you are or what life you have lived, to include sex workers and the aforementioned individuals, lifestyles, and decisions do not negate the fact that a human has had their life ended by someone else. What I do believe is even though some victims make really bad decisions, some are abusers, or whatever the case may be, those things don't negate the fact that they still had their lives snuffed out by someone else. Phyllis Chesler wrote in a St. John's Law Review article titled, A Woman's Right to Self-Defense, quote, "Burning questions still remain. Does a woman have the right to kill to prevent herself from being raped? In the past, courts have refused to impose the death penalty on rape or to hold that forced sex constitutes great bodily injury to trigger penalty enhancement, despite the fact that the consequences of rape are often lifelong and extremely debilitating. If a woman only has the right to use whatever force, short of homicide, necessary to prevent rape, how can she know exactly how much or how little force to employ to make her escape? How does a woman know that a rapist will stop at rape? Does a woman have the same right to heat of passion and rage to protect her bodily integrity and honor that men do? Does a man's 14th Amendment right to use deadly force to prevent burglary or other invasions of his home and castle cover a woman's right to prevent any unwanted invasion of her body? Is a woman's right to equality a right to have inequality taken into account? End quote. With all of that being presented to you and being said, let's begin the story and case of Eileen Warnos. Eileen Carol Pittman was born on February 29, 1956, in Rochester, Michigan. She also had an older brother born in 1953 named Keith. Their birth mother was Diane Warnos, but Eileen was told for the first 10 years of her life and believed that Laurie and Britta Warnos were her biological parents. The truth of the matter was, Laurie and Britta were Eileen and Keith's grandparents. Diane was 14 years old in 1953 when she wed Leo Pittman, who was at the time 17. 10 months later, Diane gave birth to Keith. Abuse and envy, like gasoline lit with a match, created a raging fire that engulfed Diane and Leo's relationship. Leo was hell-bent on power, attempting to control Diane's life in every way imaginable. Leo had odd jobs here and there, such as gardening and making bumpers for cars. While he was out working, Diane, like a bird in a cage, was locked away in the home under Leo's rule and couldn't leave unless she was given permission. Leo was a petty crook at first, but his crimes would gradually get more serious, eventually stealing someone's car and getting arrested. The authorities gave him two choices, either go to jail or go to the army. He chose to enlist in the army, and in 1955, Leo was off to basic training while Diane was pregnant with Eileen. When Leo left for basic training, Diane took it as an opportunity to escape the excruciating confines of her marriage, filing for divorce. Diane casted her children onto her friends when Eileen was 2 years old and Keith was around 5. Her parents, Laurie and Britta, adopted the children soon after. Diane was now regarded as an embarrassment to the family, so she was never spoken of around her children. In their community of Troy, Michigan, Laurie and Britta were considered the perfect depiction of decency, and they were respected. Laurie was the son of Finnish immigrants. He was a typical, cliché man of the 1950s, working on vehicles and being a stern disciplinarian. Britta was the caring one, the loving mother, the perfect wife. Think the Cleaver family from Leave It to Beaver. Their biological children, Lori and Barry, would glamorize their early years later on as the personification of picturesque and ideal. Diane was rejected by her family time and time again. As time went on, Diane got married again, bearing two more children. Leo never had anything to do with his children after going off to the army. After his time in the army, he went back to committing crimes, but this time, it was even worse. He disgustingly raped a 7-year-old girl and was sent to prison for it. Leo took his life in his cell in 1969 when Eileen was 13 years old. Barry and Lori may have romanticized their childhoods, or maybe life was truly that way for them, but life for Eileen and Keith was not charming and magical in the slightest. Life was especially not kind to Eileen, and she could not seem to catch a break. Her experiences were traumatic. Lori was an alcoholic who controlled the women and girls in the family. His disdain for Diane, he would take out on Eileen, and he was vicious. She would get beaten constantly by him as he released his ferocity on her as if she were his stress-relieving punching bag. If she even forgot to call him sir, he would unleash his wrath on her with his belt. Eileen may have even suffered sexual abuse by him. The truth isn't clear, as she would later claim her statements about that were not true. By the age of 12, Eileen was already lost down a dangerous path of selling her body, even if it were just for a few coins. She took whatever men and even boys at school would give her. Most children never accepted Eileen. She was being abused at home. She recently found out Lori and Britta were her biological grandparents. And allegedly, she was experimenting sexually with her brother. She felt unloved by everyone. Therefore, feeling like she was alone in this world, she searched for attention, care, and a sense of belonging in the darkest of places. When Eileen was only 14 years old, she was expecting. There is no certainty as to who the biological father is, but people heavily speculate that he was a friend of her grandfather Lori's. Eileen was now considered just as much of an embarrassment to the family as her biological mother, Diane, and Lori and Britta didn't want to deal with Eileen and threw her out of the home into the streets. Eileen gave birth to a little boy at a home for unwed mothers in Detroit. She chose to put her baby up for adoption because she knew she couldn't give him everything a child needs. After she put the baby up for adoption, she was allowed back into Lori's home. Britta had passed away shortly after Eileen had given birth. Eileen wasn't very much welcomed and accepted in the home. She already felt alienated and she held a lot of resentment inside of her soul. At this point, she became unpredictable and unstable. She grew to hate men, as she only ever knew men who were awful beings. She saw men only as predators who were out to use and abuse women. Eileen went to high school for a few months and then dropped out. At first, she would abide by her grandfather's rules and wishes, but she had so much hatred towards Lori that it made her cold towards him, and she would push him further away. After she dropped out of school, it wasn't long before she found herself in a juvenile detention center. While she was there, she became quite the pool shark, which was a skill she'd come to use to her advantage on down the line when she would make money by being a pool hustler. After she got out of juvenile detention, she was living under her grandfather's roof again, but that didn't last very long. Eileen tried to run away so many times that Laurie told her not to come back. Eileen again found herself not having a place to go, wandering the streets and succumbing to illegal sex work and stealing to financially survive. When the sun would rise, Eileen would get around by hitchhiking, and she dabbled in the realm of drugs and alcohol. She would spend her nights making her bed in cars left unlocked or the woods. When Eileen was 18 years old, she was committing petty theft, but would soon drift into committing more serious offenses. The police arrested her in 1974 for disorderly conduct, driving under the influence, and shooting a .22 caliber pistol out of a moving car in Jefferson County, Colorado. She was going by the name Sandra Beatrice Kresh. In 1976, Eileen was back in Michigan, and police arrested her again in Antrim County. This time, it was for simple assault and disturbing the peace. On top of that, she was wanted for drinking alcohol inside of a vehicle and driving without a license. Eileen became bolder, more brazen with the crimes she committed, and on May 20, 1981, she committed armed robbery at a convenience store in Edgewater, Florida, and was arrested. Later, Eileen would say she wasn't there to rob the place, but to, quote, blow her brains out. Eileen spent a year stewing in a Florida prison cell. When she was released, she was back to doing what she did best and really the only thing she knew how to do, commit crimes. Eileen began to forge checks, commit Grand Theft Auto, and she was in possession of illegal weapons, stealing weapons, and more than a few times committed assault and battery. She was in and out of jail often. She attempted to use many different names so she wouldn't get busted, even using Laurie and Britta's daughter, Laurie Grody's name. Throughout this time, Eileen was in and out of relationships which were all toxic and violent. This only proved more to her that all men were the same, and she despised them. She also had a short-lived marriage with a 60-year-old yacht club president in 1976 for about a month before it ended due to Eileen's claims that he would take a cane and assault her with it. But there are other stories that she was the one who would assault him and he had a restraining order on her. At this point, Eileen had been an illegal sex worker for so long, and she only knew men to be abusive pricks. She was a guarded lone wolf, distrustful and wary of men, even though she felt she needed them to survive financially. Eileen's brother Keith passed away from esophageal cancer on July 17, 1976. And shortly after, to her surprise, she received $10,000 from his life insurance policy. She bought a car, but wrecked it not long after buying it. The rest of the money she wasted away. Her grandfather, Laurie, also died by taking his own life shortly after Keith passed. Eileen moved to Florida, where she was in and out of jail for a decade. When she was 22 years old in 1978, she attempted to take her own life by shooting herself in the stomach. This was not her first attempt. Between the ages of 14 and 22, she tried to take her own life about 6 times. At 30 years old, Eileen met a 24-year-old woman by the name of Tyra Jolene Moore in the spring of 1986 at the Zodiac Bar in South Daytona Beach. Tyra was from a modest conservative town in Ohio, and she decided at the age of 26 she needed to pick up and leave for a place that was more accepting of gay people. Eileen and Tyra made a connection right off the bat, and from the first time they met, they never left each other's side. This was the love Eileen had been searching for all her life. Eileen was persuaded by Tyra to do more illegal sex work than she had been, because Tyra wanted to quit her job, and Eileen wanted her to be able to do that and still survive. They were in a rough spot and needed the money to stay longer stints in hotel rooms and to purchase drugs and alcohol. Eileen later said that Tyra would drink all their money away and she couldn't make money fast enough. The two would also commit petty crimes together, such as stealing from pawn shops. They were together for 3 years, and at some point their love began to fizzle out. As their romance was coming to an end, they were nothing more than two women roaming around together who lived challenging lives, but they felt they needed to stick together to survive the cruel world. In 1990, Tyra had allegedly become suspicious, if not entirely informed, that Eileen had done something drastic. She said Eileen began behaving strangely, and it gave her overwhelming anxiety. Whatever Tyra knew or did not know drove her to leave Florida and live with her family in Pennsylvania. This concludes part one. Next week, I'll dive into Eileen's murderous crimes and the victims. Thank you for listening to part one of this series. Until next time, stay safe and take care.